and how they negotiated their roles in cultural and church context. offering is the theological and moral. And finally, I'll conclude with some rather comments. But first, why is this question important? The question about that I have up here about the thing between the two. I would suggest it's important for two reasons. One, because in addition to biblical study, I think we can learn from cultural lens some things that may help clarify our understanding. But I think it may help to clarify our understanding of issues. If we know something about how the space is negotiated, it may help us say, yes, I can see that. I can see how this may be a factor. And then the second reason I think it's an important question is because we have a long way to go as we try to continue to work through those goals. Education matters, and there is room for progress. Currently, we are a movement that is not completely egalitarian in our public worship, and I think we will all benefit from your study. And again, we have some excellent biblical studies that are going on, and hopefully with some of the Kinsey Crossing sessions and others this week. I just again, because I was in a conversation with him last night, and I'm familiar with his work, and I think it's very good. But back to the ethnographies. There are ethnographies about evangelical women. Now, I don't consider the Church of Christ to be evangelical in many ways, but I think the evangelical positions and sessions about women are somewhat parallel to those in the Church of Christ. And the reason I use those also is because there's not that many done by Church of Christ congregations that we can look at. So it's important to look at what it is that. And moving right along. The two ethnographical studies in which we'd like to look at at some point in the future is Skeleton of the Living Women's Mission, Evangelical Women and Association of Patriarchy in South Korea, and then Arnold Rickler's book, God's Daughters, Evangelical Women and Power Exhibition. And then the third one, Alec Hackett's book, As Protestant History of the Church, understanding and leadership of the nation. Some of you may not be familiar with what an ethnography is. And let me say that the best way to talk about an ethnography, there's lots of ethnographies being done today, but it's basically an attempt to talk about lived religion. Lived religion. It requires the person who's writing the book to be an excellent researcher and a participant on the ground with the people that he or she studies. So they would be doing interviews. They would be looking at materials that are printed. They would be looking at the history of a given group. But I think the best way to understand a particular religious group, what's going on in the congregation, it's available to look at what's going on the ground. What is it that they are believing? What is it that they are acting out? What is it that they think is the meaning behind various doctrines in the church? And again, that's it's all what we call lived religion, which is if you want to know what's really going on, talk to the people who are living in what they say. So this first ethnography about evangelical women in South Korea but South Korea is a good place to look, an interesting place to look. Probably different work in the late 1990s. South Korea, the entire population is about 22% evangelical today. That's the highest concentration of evangelicals in the Asian world. In the United States, it's about 27-29%. So, yes, there's a gap, but a good number of evangelicals exist in South Korea. The big issues that goes in there are one of them, the first one would be a large church outside Seoul. The largest evangelical church in South Korea says they have 350,000 members. So we're talking about huge numbers of people. This one, though, is smaller. But you can see that they're very interested in modern architecture. And so the church is built in a way that they think it's very accommodating to the latest things that people need. Like we built maybe a baseball city in the United States. So, and the second picture shows what it looks like a typical church building. The churches that Tom worked with, one was an evangelical Presbyterian and one was an evangelical Methodist church. She conducted over 100 interviews with well-educated middle-class women who claimed the affiliation with one of these churches. I think each one had about 8 to 10,000 members. They both practiced an understanding that women's role was one of submission to men. And one of the interesting things about South Korea, just to give you a little historical context, that South Korea had a good number of rights for women prior to the 1400s, which was when Neo-Confucianism comes in. And at that point, the subjugation of women was enforced and created very high restrictions and limitations on them, including limited education. Literacy was only in the daughter. One of the most interesting things is carried on, though, is that even though a lot of that is not true today, one thing that continues to be true is that young brides marry and move into the home of their husband's parents. Well, or the mother moves in with them, whichever the case may be, that they have a close relationship with the mother-in-law, let's say, literally. And in this arrangement, the mother-in-law is given a lot of control over the new daughter-in-law. And in fact, according to Tom, the two primary functions of the daughter-in-law is to produce sons and produce and provide domestic labor. And for the woman, the new body best hope is if she produces a son, then someday when her son grows up and gets married, then she will get served to work with her, right? So that's going on, and modernization has caused, I think the millennials are really challenging this in South Korea. But if you talk to women who were born in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, that's still alive for later experience. And Paul's main question was, why do women who live in a somewhat patriarchal culture and who are expected to submit to their husbands at home choose to join a religious group in which they may or must practice submission? Why do they do that? Which kind of gets back to the first question I raised early on. On the one hand, women reported freedom of Christ. On the other hand, the church produced the traditional directives that wives would submit to husbands in home, elsewhere, and follow the church's teachings. Paul's study led her to conclude that women in South Korea wanted a relational faith, and they found peace in the masculine God, who often seemed to take the place of a father or a husband. A masculine deity, what did he do for them? He loved her unconditionally. He loved her unconditionally. And then they somehow, Paul says, somehow they accepted the paradox. They accepted the contradictions. Yes, there was still male authority, and what if they could tell what they could do? However, they were empowered. Because they had opportunities to get out of their home. And in addition to that, their church work, where they could keep Bible studies with other women, pray with other women, provided them with a certain amount of prestige. And so they were negotiating this power in the church in ways that were beneficial to them. The church also constantly told them that they were responsible for disharmony, underneath their obedience to their husbands and their mothers-in-law, they were angry. A lot of them were filled with anger. But they would fight for that anger over to God. And they would try to spend the Bible more, pray more, and had a hope that they could become believers. Paul discovered, the importance of the home to these women was a monumental consequence. They wanted a better home life, and the church seemed to be offering them one way to improve their situations. And this is an important concern. She concludes that some African women wanted an emancipated home life more than they wanted to be emancipated from home. They wanted an emancipated home life more than they wanted to be emancipated from home. So overall, what South Korean can develop as a new force is a high value placed on women's safety, while at the same time offering women personal achievement and a more empowered and reconstituted self-identity, as you often say. The positive outcomes, the benefits that she got from that, included increased confidence, individual self-fulfillment, and opportunities for learning and further self-development. So yes, there was freedom in Christ that came through what she was doing in the church. All people were people in the eyes of God, but the church was saying, in a limited way. The church continued to reinforce the need to submit to husbands, to women, to mothers-in-law, and to keep silent in church as a given church would. Paul saw this fact paradox as complicated and as a kind of dance that the women were doing. She said they were simultaneously leading lives of deliverance and submission, lives where they were constantly negotiating between the constraints and the freedom of the cross. And thus the title of her book, Deliverance and Submission. This negotiated space required that they continue to submit. However, they could feel less angry and more capable because of what the church had called. And the church served to empower them while at the same time reinforcing the cultural neo-confusion ideas. Now, this case study raises several different questions. One is, how much is the South Korean story culturally specific to South Korea? How much is reflecting of an evangelical culture that is actually cross-cultural? And thirdly, is that some suggest that perhaps it's reflective of a culture similar to that in the United States. And if so, what does that mean? Right. Put the moment in all of that. But I'll make another comment about the 1950s. In this one way, it does seem that in the 1950s and 60s, there were a lot of angry women in the United States. And those women sometimes reported that they were feeling trapped, that they felt like their beautiful suburban homes were the latest appliances, were not meeting their needs, and they wanted something more. They didn't feel like their life was meaningful. That domestic kind of life was one that they were wanting out of. Some women chose to go to work at that particular time. But if you look at women's Bible studies, they were often made up in that time period, if you look back at some of the literature of evangelicals, that expressed, that felt good expressions of women who were very angry. And then when you trace that forward, you see the validity, so that there was fewer women in that age group to be angry, and others were not so angry. So you have a kind of fluidity in the women's groups who were reading, studying the Bible, praying together in the United States. So you might have extremely angry women on the one hand, and women who were totally embracing the book of the total woman, who didn't even refer to that book, on the other hand. So this was negotiated. This is the point here. South Korea is still negotiating this. The United States negotiated it. You can't make the conclusion that perhaps what's going on in South Korea today may be similar to what's going on here in the 1950s. But I think it's clear that the God's daughter to the biblical women and power of submission is about the Women's World Fellowship. He's mainly Assembly of God, President. It's now been called, it's not called, Globe International. It's one of the largest women's religious organizations in the world. It started in 1967 with 4 members. It exists in 170 nations today. In the United States, it's primarily white and middle class. And their particular work is also done in the Assembly in the mid-90s. And again, she worked over extensive field work and put it out in the community meetings that bring a lot of material that is published. This largest picture image is a palace that's on in the National. It's called points to the power of the prayer of life. That a lot goes on because we believe that God answers prayers. It continues, the flow from 67 forward has continued to promote a traditional account that prays fervently to a male God who will help with the limitations that they experience in their own families. It's basically repertoire of many stories about wanting a healed or redemptive family life. They work to develop a close relationship with Jesus. This is different from the relationship they might have with their husbands and fathers. And those relationships are direct. It is not a relationship with their husbands. And in these ways, you see some similarities in South Korea. Some scholars have suggested that there is a strong therapeutic culture in the global organizations. God can change things, God can change the name of the women they feel. And another thing that comes out from this study is the power of submission. I want to tell you a little bit of what she finds from the studying and reading the global literature. That in the early period, from the 60s and 70s, the women were encouraged to submit to their husbands, even when husbands were abusive. They were encouraged to take it, because that is what they believed God wanted them to do. And in 1974, there was a Bible study book published by a local woman called God's Daughter. It went through 14 countries. And one of the points made in the book was that women received a benefit from submission, which was they got protection from their husbands. And so submission was a way that they were free to do some things that they were protected. And I want to give you the analogy that stuck out to her, and I think it's a very important one. She said, in a movement, a train is planned to run on track. As long as the train stays on its track, it's due to fulfill that provision was made. When it jumps the track, chaos results. Secondly, when you guys see the importance of that, a certain understanding of women, maybe in the past, but certainly one that we may have heard. The woman concluded that women should not try to emulate the role reversal so often called for by society. But they should stick with their roles as homemakers. And in 1974, that was a success. However, by 1985, that chapter in that book was revised. And at this point, in 1985, the book started talking about Jesus' submission to God. And there wasn't much said about gender submission at all. In fact, author said, submission to our husbands does not make us second-class citizens or those who are ranked lower on the voting roll, as much as we would say our husbands. We have a side-by-side relationship. So even though gender roles are still fought in some ways, it was fought more in the context of mutual submission. So they too were in transition. The woman's goal in the family is that she wanted to make benefits were to, you know, huge benefits to them and their family. Now, Ruth mentions work, and she says that by the 1990s, you begin to get work being a part of the world literature. And it worked for you in the 1990s. So it's even a tendency to lie about what a model career woman might look like. And this is necessary because there are so many women going into the workforce. The global organization adapted to the changing culture, one of which economics became important. So the somewhat common assumption emerged that a family is stronger, a family unit is stronger, if it can be financially stronger, or if there is financial stability. Right? If you can guarantee that, then that would be a good thing. And so the idea in the world was that Christian womanhood still involved male compliance. But there was some particular uncertainties that women were not proud of that they were willing to talk about. And they began to their interest in work began to more of a focus. So what does this study, or what might this study, have to say to Church of Christ? If you look at me, many sociological studies that talk about the effects of women going to work in our society. Whenever we think of culture, there are three prominent institutions. There's the home, the public square, the activity outside of home, including workplace, and the church. This slide is really getting to the heart of this presentation. Submission at home seems to be a foundation to understanding submission in church. Because you understand something about how that's been working out in the second half of the 20th century in evangelical homes, you may understand more about how it works out in Christian lives as well. In the late 19th century, there were few women who worked outside the home. But that changed. You know, early 20th century, you begin to read about the first women who go into medicine, or law, or journalism. And I quite quote me, right? But by the second half of the 20th century, large numbers of women were pursuing professional careers. And by the 1980s, large numbers of evangelical women were working. This meant that women's space in the home and the work world, the public sphere, had to be renegotiated. Now, I went somewhere, I haven't looked at every copy, but I looked at some copies of the Gospel Advocate, which is a magazine, a journal, that tells us something about what some of our ministers are thinking various times in our own district. And in the 70s and 80s, I've seen some comments made by some preachers that were not positive for women in work. And you probably have seen those and you've heard about those. There have been some churches that have made an issue of it in some ways. But is it a fairly quiet issue? Many over the last 20 years, and it was never one that was divisive, as far as I know, with the church. And now, in 2015, it seems somewhat accepted that women and men can both go to work if they want to. Under the same premise used in the early 1950s, that it was good for families to have a mind of so many financial ways. But the interesting thing is, it's become a matter of negotiation between the woman and her husband. The wife and the husband work out what they do in terms of work, right? I mean, we did, when we asked you questions about how many of you have wives or husbands who work, and the answer probably be many. But if I start asking he thinks about, he does the laundry, or he cooks the meals, or he cuts the trash, or, you know, any of those things about home, those are probably negotiated between the two of you, and all at all times. So anyway, Kirk asks you, how are you doing it? Well, I think you just do that and work it out. It's a practical matter. That's not the way it was at the turn of the century, the 19th and 20th century. If a woman worked, you find lots of people commenting and saying, what kind of man would allow her to do that? Or what kind of immoral woman, or whatever word you want to use to describe a moral woman, would dare do that to her husband and her family? It brings real rebuke on all of them. The church as well. He was a moral problem. It was a theological problem. And it was not one that, at that time, the church thought was survivable. There were a lot of people who thought, this is going to destroy the family if we allow this to happen. But now we see that that didn't happen. The fears about women working are not fears that we usually have very often. And so, on this slide, we have a home here, and women needed in a home here at work. And then they go back home, and there has to be a negotiated space. The women, when they get into this space over here, there are all kinds of new questions in their lives. What about maternity leave? What about whether women should supervise men in these jobs? What about whether or not women should make the same amount of money as men make in this space? And basically, some of those issues are still with us. Some of that is still being negotiated. Again, though, this is a matter of negotiation done in the context of the people involved. Again, you don't get to hear stories of the church getting involved in what Susan and John worked out for the work branch, right? So, the most part of that is going to be with Israel. But now we come back to, so, what about this is a hot topic? And I didn't get to see the token show Tuesday night, but I understand that you were there. Women's roles were a hot topic. Is that for you? Did you ever hear that? Okay. One of you. Okay, great. So what's a hot topic? It's certainly not around submission. And in fact, this is just anecdotal. And I may not be right about this, but it occurs to me that most of the time when I'm talking to a couple, actually, if I'm talking to the male, and I say something like, well, maybe you guys could come over to see Molly. His response, for years, his response has been, if he's older, he would say, well, you'll have to check with the wife. And if he's younger, he would say, well, you'll have to ask, you know, Susie or whatever. It became clear to me that very few men are employed in social calendar. And if you ask, well, could your children have a play date with, you know, my niece and my nephew, the man would say, something, you'll have to check the law, or you'll have to check the condition of her name. Now, if you go to church or they go to church, you will still hear that the line is, women submit to men, right? But have you had an experience where that's what we're saying, but that's not what's happening at home, that it's negotiated? And you all understand that negotiation better than I do, but you know that it's negotiated, and you work out what works for you. Now, but in the most part, you know, I still say that in church families today, it's fairly common to hear both fathers and mothers telling and encouraging their little girls to grow up and to be whatever they want to be. This is the encouragement for new boys to be whatever they want to be. That's a step forward. It's a step where we're setting their own limits, and we are encouraging create limitations. Now, it's difficult for the church in the middle here to remain free of the influences of what's going on over here and what's going on over here. Lots of negotiation. So it seems somewhat normal to me to think, why do we expect the church to be free of the conversation about what we can do there? It's not about being rebellious. It's not about being angry. In 2015, it's about we live with industry and public institutions, and two of them are actively negotiating and renegotiating space. And this one is attempting to do that, but there's still quite a bit of resistance. There's some comfort for me when I think about it that way, because it's not about anything personal. It's about looking at it in the larger context of what it is. And that's what I mean when I say culture is working to our advantage here. We can say all kinds of church institutions are working through this. And if we take it in that context, we recognize that wherever the church is on the pendulum, it's important to be there and to be supportive of their own renegotiations that they may or may not be happening. It makes sense that in a world with these three institutions, renegotiating, that if you had someone in your church who was female and the CEO or CFO of a company, that you might want to consider her when you're talking about your own church budget. Or if you had somebody in your church who was a well-known speaker, motivational speaker, or a well-known teacher, you might want to consider her for teaching. If you had someone who is dynamic in wanting to preach the gospel and do that, you might want to consider that happening in your church. And it might make a lot of sense, not only because of the calendar, but in the context of recognizing the renegotiation that is taking place. So, for much of the 20th century, men and women participated based pretty much strictly on going back and forth about the biblical narrative. And that's an extremely important point, the biblical narrative. And we can really talk about that today. And it's important to talk about that. But whether it's just discussing the biblical narrative or looking at it somewhat sociologically, the thing that I would suggest is that a really good word to use is a collage when thinking about the church today. That it's not this way or that way. It's not a dichotomy. It's not either or. But every church puts its own post-it on the collage, so to speak. And every post-it note is a little different. And that's one of the beauties of having congregational autonomy. And so when you look at it and step back, you see a collage that's filled with the negotiation. Filled with a lot of grace and respect, but not a collage that's attempting to take one post-it off or throw a post-it away simply because it's not done the same way. The collage is important. So to get back to the question that sent me down this road to start with, why are some women interested and why are some women not so interested? One thing as an academic that I would suggest that I came to the conclusion of after going through all this is that it has a lot to do with how they negotiated their own space. Now, we may be able to draw other conclusions from these hypotheses, but that one seems pretty solid to me. That as we look at how individuals benefit in the way their particular space has been negotiated, they may be resistant to giving up that their arrangement, this is working for them. And if you see other women who have renegotiated the space and it's not working for them, then they may want to participate in the renegotiation. So I think it does say something. Although, like I said, I think there's a lot of work to be done there. But we need to rethink our views of how we come to hold what we believe to be true. Not to take away from the negotiations, but to simply be willing to add to them other possibilities of how we may look at something we're going to do. The third book that I mentioned earlier by Alan Padgett, Advice Against the Church, Biblical Understanding of Leadership and Mutual Submission. This book was published in 2011. He's attempting to create another lens through which to view the biblical story on this, and he suggests that in the New Testament there are two ways the word submission is used. Type 1 submission, as he refers to it, is obedience to an external authority, sometimes voluntary and sometimes involuntary. But it is always hierarchical. And here we have a lot of examples of that. The government. You can be a private, you can be a lieutenant, you can be a youth specialist, one, or whatever. There's a hierarchy, right? In government and in military. In law enforcement, we see the same thing. In a company, there are supervisors, there are managers. But then he says there are type 2 submission in the New Testament, and that's a recognition of voluntary submission out of love and compassion. It's applied as mutual submission to all members of the body. It's internal and it's personal. Basically, Padgett is submitted to what he calls Christocentric ethics. And you hear that phrase a lot these days. Christocentric ethics. That is, one learns about God's expectations for submission by looking at the life of Christ. You learn about the expectations for submission by looking at the life of Christ. And I'm privately to the church. Padgett suggests that from foot washing to dying on the cross, Jesus modeled submission to the law of God. His unique argument is that man-centered top-down leadership is neither biblical nor evangelical, and he's writing against that evangelical argument that's often called the complementarian model. But it's Christ-centered. It's not concerned with issues of gender so much as how shall the disciples of Jesus use their God-given power in social institutions. And he says the Christian leader is the one who takes up the role of servant, just as Jesus did. And that is the quotation I put here, is Advent. It's a Christ-centered ethic focusing on leading, discerning, and God's work. Constantly call back to the service aspect of it. Unfortunately, the church too often models the culture that we impose a hierarchical model more like the military or government than the model of leadership and service that Jesus did. Throughout the centuries, in most cultures, women have had walls built around what they can do. And yes, progress is coming, and I certainly want to applaud the progress. And one of the things that I've noticed lately, though, is that sometimes this progress is there in some churches or money to depend on, but then it stops. And the church may say, we've gone as far as we can go. We've allowed women to teach males, we've allowed women to pray. And I say, yeah, that's good. As long as we understand that it's a temporary stop, it's a brief respite along the way. The goal is to remove all the labels, to remove all the labels that divide people, including women and men, and keep mutual submission as a goal, serve a leadership. If I should serve a circle of leadership never rules walls. The walls affect the numbers of kids down by at least 50% for women who are excluded. And I really didn't tell that story too. You know, we use ropes, we don't see the ropes, but there's always a rope there when you're about to walk in the pulpit, right? Over the years. It, like you might, you know, throw off an area for a wedding. We all know that the rope is invisible, it's not there for men, but it's there for women. At least it has been in between places in the community and some. But to recognize that it's, this is not the root. That both men and women remain women of God. We have absolutely no evidence in the New Testament that Jesus ever built a wall or created space to cut women out. And it's not the focus there on Christ-centric leadership and Christ-centric ethics. I think that we would be much better prepared to remove a wall and much better. Much better understanding of these situations. So, I guess to put this all together, back to the first slide here. As we continue to study the Bible, as we continue to work together in dialogue, I would suggest a new area, not entirely new, but that we might want to look into submission in very detail and see if we're beginning to see. Examples and matters of how the relationship of submission at home may directly impact the kinds of ways we experience submission in the church. So I see the line coming in the past time. I'm sorry about that. Again, if you have a question, I am willing to stay around, but I'm also finding some other judgments to go through. So